Let me ask our regents, advisors, and others to take seats, and we can call to order the Board of Regents meeting, an open session. First item of business, as is usually the case, is our public comment section. So I'm going to ask the secretary to read our rules on public comment. We're happy to have folks here speaking to us and talking to us about the things they're concerned with. So, Madam Secretary.
Thank you. The notice you received when you entered the auditorium set out rules for public comment and for conduct during the meetings today. If you would like to review them and need a copy, please raise your hand and our staff member will get you a copy. This morning we have about 42 speakers who have signed up to address the regents. Each individual speaker will have up to 1 minute to address the regents. A couple of you have pooled your time to your colleagues. If you've pooled your time, I think I have three of you, pooled speakers will get 2.5 minutes. I don't give you a warning, however, at the end of your time, my little timer goes off. So since we do have so many speakers and we'd like to really try and hear from as many as we can, please be mindful of those speakers who will follow you. And when your time is up, please conclude your remarks. The microphones at the front of the public seating, I'm going to call 5 speakers at a time. So if you could queue up and be ready to speak, that will move things along also. I may not read your name in order because we do have so many speakers. We're going to try and we'll extend the 20-minute period, but if I skip you, don't worry. I may be able to circle back. Also, if someone's name is called who's not in the room, our staff member will go out and make sure they're able to come in the room when it's their turn to speak. Written comment is also important to regents. You may give any written materials you've brought with you to our staff member who's out in the audience with you. Those materials will be available to regents for the duration of the two-day meeting. Also, if you don't finish your statement and you have it in writing, our staff member is happy to take it. So, first 5 speakers, and once again, 1 minute each. Adilis Perez, Kylie Murdoch, Riza Estacio, and Uha Kalfe, and Andrea Hess. Sorry. Once I've called your name, any order you wish to speak is just fine. Just let us know who you are before you begin.
And just let me just repeat what the secretary said, is that we do have a number of speakers, so this will take a little time, so be prepared to sit and, as usual, listen as well as we can. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Idalis Perez. I'm here as a second-year student from UC Berkeley on behalf of the Associated Students of the University of California, representing 36,000 students on our campus. Since Betsy DeVos's efforts to repeal Title IX, the UC President Janet Napolitano has promised to allegedly stick to the zero non-tolerance policy of sexual assault and violence. These standards are expected to be held to every student, every worker, and every regent that is a part of the UC accountable. However, Regent Norman Pattis has faced sexual harassment allegation from last fall in 2016, sustained by a recording of him and an actress at his company. Regent Pattis says, "Wait a minute, can I hold your breast? Would that help?" Recognizing that statistics are stories, this is just one story of an allegation that is part of statistics of sexual harassment faced in the workplace. The actress later quits. Now, a year later, where's the accountability? The UC represents 9 campuses and 240,000 students across the state. Therefore, we expect our regents who represent us to always maintain accountability for their actions and demanding for the resignation of Norman Pattis. Thank you.
Good morning, Board of Regents. My name is Kylie Murdoch, and I'm a member of the Legislative Department of the ASUC and a peer educator for Greeks Against Sexual Assault. 80% of college women don't report their experience of sexual assault or harassment, and it's because of situations like this where women's experiences are disregarded and men do not face consequences for their actions. After Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos rolled back Title IX protections, UC President Napolitano said, "I want to stress that UC's pledge to protect our students and employees from sexual violence and sexual harassment remains unchanged. If you claim to be committed to this issue, then why have you not fired a man who has been accused by multiple women of sexual harassment? We talk about not tolerating the sort of behavior from men in Hollywood and even from our current president, so why should we tolerate it from a regent? You represent students, and we no longer want Regent Pattis to represent us. So I ask you to hold Regent Pattis accountable for his actions. As a survivor of sexual violence, I ask you to fire him. Thank you."
Good morning, Regents. My name is Riza Stasio, and I'm a senator with the Associate Students of the University of California. And as a consent educator and survivor, the issues of sexual violence hold the utmost importance. You might ask why we are here and why we care so deeply about Regent Petit's alleged crimes. It's because when individuals such as Governor Brown and Lieutenant Governor Newsom and cohorts such as the Board of Regents allow sexual misconduct allegations to fester and remain unaddressed, and perpetrators, allegedly or otherwise, unpunished, you set the precedent that sexual harassment and assault and gender-based violence is a minor offense, and someone's inability to recognize consent and humanity is secondary to their accomplishments, wealth, and accolades. You set this precedent for our administrators, professors, and fellow students, that women's bodies are objects meant to be oppressed and violated, and no punishment is necessary for the perpetrators if they are wealthy enough. Governor Brown, who appoints the regents, how can you permit someone to continuously sit on the Board of Regents, hike our tuition, and raise our chancellor's salaries when they do not represent the morals of equality and inclusivity that the UC stands for? And Lieutenant Governor Newsom, don't think that we will forget this as your gubernatorial race continues. And the voting students of the UC system will be hard-pressed to forget this negligence.
Good morning, Regents. My name is Nuha Kalfe, and I am a senator with the Associated Students of the University of California. As a woman on a UC campus and as a representative for the 15,000 plus undergraduate women at UC Berkeley, this issue is of the utmost importance to me personally. This issue is also of the utmost importance to the Associate Students of the University of California and the UC Students Association. We will continue to do everything in our power to make sure we are holding you, our representatives, accountable. We will be at every Regents meeting in strong numbers. Can I have everyone here from a UC student campus stand, please? We will be here in strong numbers until Norman Petit is removed or resigns from his post as a UC regent. We urge you to hold Norman Petit accountable, to show us in a tangible way that you really do support and prioritize survivors, women, and students that you were appointed to represent. We ask you in the strongest possible terms to take a stand and not just a stance on this issue. And if that does not happen, I assure you, you will see us next month and every month after that. Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Andrea Hesse, and I am staff, alumni, volunteer, and contributor at UC Santa Cruz with a near 40-year relationship to the campus. For the past 3 years, my colleagues and I have been driving 3 hours to provide 3 minutes of input on the compensation, workload, and retention issues, challenges facing staff. On July 24th, we sent a memo to President Napolitano recapping our persistent concerns and requesting feedback, which by the rules of order does not occur here. Having received no response, we now offer that memo to any member of this body who is willing to take a few moments to read its content. We believe that professional staff are foundational to every aspect of this enterprise, and the continued erosion of our professional efficacy creates serious risk to institutional continuity, safety, security, compliance, and reputation. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'll hear from Lynn Sheehan, Rob Kerner, Zoe Broussard, Becky Hofstein-Grady, Rubid Alvera, and that's five. Any order you want to speak is fine. Go ahead.
Hello, everyone. My name is Zoe Broussard. I'm the External Vice President at UC Irvine, and I serve as the Chair of University Affairs for UCSA. Today, I'm here to speak on one of the initiatives that we will be pushing this year. It's called 3D. It stands for Demand, Disability Resources, and Diversification. Ensuring that the UC remains accessible for all students includes committing to improving resources for students with disabilities. While the UC increases in its enrollment size, it also follows that there will be projected increases in infrastructure. Buildings themselves remain accessible only by the minimum legal standards and not in a way that considers how students with disabilities may most conveniently and most holistically use campus spaces. Although there are legal guidelines for building and increasing infrastructure on each campus, consulting with disability resource centers on each campus will push developers to go beyond the minimum for the Americans with Disabilities Act. We are urging all UC stakeholders to support and take action to make the consultation mandatory for all new buildings on each campus. We, the students from UCSA, would be grateful to have your support. Thank you.
Hello, good morning. My name is Rubid, and I'm a student, and I'm part of the UCN Document Student Coalition. As you know, DACA has been removed, and many people's lives are at stake, including many undocumented students across the UC. So I'm here to ask for you to continue to advocate for students and ensure that the bill to support SB 68 that supports undocumented students and accessibility and affordability. I also ask that you find creative ways within existing law to provide stipends and paid internships of opportunities for professional development, regardless of a student's immigration status. So I ask that you support AB 1037, which allows for that to happen. I also ask that you allocate physical space within with professional staff and ensure that permanent funding is provided for all undocumented student resources and centers. And finally, to ensure funding for all students, including graduate students who recently have been affected by the removal of DACA and are in limbo in their TA-ships and fellowships. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Becky Hofstein Grady. I'm a PhD student at UC Irvine, and I'm here to ask for your support in fighting against provisions of the House Republicans' tax plan that would devastate higher education. In particular, one of the provisions of this bill would tax the tuition waivers that PhD students receive as part of being a teaching or research assistant. This would increase the tax burden on the typical out-of-state first-year teaching assistant by over 400%, reducing their income to less than $14,000. This would turn affording graduate school from difficult to impossible, leaving education accessible only to the wealthy. I'm asking for your support in two ways. One, use your influential voices to lobby Congress against these harmful provisions. Two, I ask for you to consider changes in the structure of how graduate students are paid so that the way that the tuitions are charged and waived to graduate students isn't subject to this in the future. This has come up before and will again, and graduate students live in fear that next year's tax plan could take away their ability to continue their schooling. I urge you to continue these conversations to protect higher education accessibility for all. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Lynn Sheehan, a UC Santa Cruz IT staff member with 30 years experience. The recent announcement by Office of the President to further erode our retirement benefits is one of the many attacks facing staff at UC. The recent bargaining with the technical unit where UC is offering a 2% increase is another example, not to mention the outsourcing of IT jobs at UC campuses. To further exacerbate the attack, UC has decided to fight the recent accretion of the system administrators after two rulings by the PERB. Unrepresented staff in the middle are being squeezed and feel as though we are an afterthought. The wage increases this year have barely allowed us to keep up with the cost of living and the cost of coming to work. Do the right thing. Stand up for us in the middle. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Rob Kerner. I'm an IT manager in the Department of Plant Sciences at UC Davis, and I'll give you an opposite view to that. I want to thank the President, Janet Napolitano, and Vice President Dwayne Duckett for fighting for system administrators. Accretion is forcing system administrators to be represented by UPTI without hearing their voice. Now, I fully support union representation, but it should be the choice of those staff involved to be represented by the union and not being forced. And Lieutenant Governor Newsom, please talk to your boss. The Public Employees Relations Board is a 5-person board who currently have 3 members sitting on it. And the governor has a tendency to leave positions open. And I don't think that helps the positions of the board. I also want to thank the Santa Cruz staff members. Like she said, they come almost every meeting. It takes them 3 to 5 hours to get here to talk to you about total compensation and the erosion of our staff members. Please look into being able to give staff a reasonable raise that not only keeps up with inflation, but does something about keeping positive staff on these campuses. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next we'll hear from Rigel Robinson, Sarah Abdeshahian, and then I have 8 people from California Nurses signed up to speak, so what I'd like to do is ask 5 of you, you can self-select to speak so that we can hear from all groups. So Rigel, Sarah, and then 5 from CNA.
Good morning, Regents. Thank you for having us. My name is Desiree Mathos, and I work in the NICU at UCI Medical Center. I have worked there for 21 years and take pride in my work taking care of the sickest babies. We are a very large unit and one of the only one of its kind in the country. We work very hard and sometimes under difficult circumstances, oftentimes short-staffed and without proper meals and breaks. As a result of the layoffs and cost cutting at UCI, the staff and patients, have suffered tremendously. Staffing is bare minimum in a unit with intensely sick babies is irresponsible and short-sighted in the part of the university. As I'm nearing my retirement, I'm disheartened with UC's proposal to reduce our pension benefits. I've worked half of my life hard for the university. I've worked for less pay than I would have at other major medical centers. I've stayed here for my patients, for my retirement security. I want the future of nurses who come after me to have the same peace of mind that I've had, knowing that if you work hard all your life for the University of California, you will retire. I beg you to consider to stop taking away our pension. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Travis Wallace. I'm a registered nurse at UC San Diego. I've been a nurse for 12 years with the last 4 years at UCSD. I'm a proud member of CNA and a nurse representative. I'm here to let you know that nurses are extremely upset over the university's proposals to do away with several important protections and basic rights in our contract. After decades of having no mandatory overtime, the proposal to reinstate mandatory overtime is unbelievable. Not knowing when your shift will end causes anxiety and chaos. The university is proposing to do away with their obligation to post schedules 14 days in advance. That would make it virtually impossible to have a personal life. The proposal to allow managers to cancel staff RNs before contract workers or travelers is not only disrespectful, but will jeopardize nurses' incomes even more. And the proposal to eliminate protections against shift rotation from days to nights, nights to days, is dangerous for the nurses and the patients. These proposals and the proposals to undermine our pension are an attack on our families and our quality of our lives. These proposals expand management's rights at the expense of families and our personal lives. For all the talk of core values and supporting work-life balance, the university is trying to turn back the clock to a place where we don't want to go.
Time.
We demand that the university negotiate a contract that recruits, retains, and respects our nurses.
Good morning. My name is Natalia Cardenas. I'm a registered nurse at UCLA Medical Center. I have worked at UCLA since 2004, and since 2007, I have worked as a part of the medical center's float and resource team. We're a group of per diem nurses who are able to work in multiple units and have numerous specialties. We're called upon to cover units when nurses call off sick or are on vacation or are off for whatever reason. We ensure that the hospital is able to run efficiently and that our patients are given the best possible care. UC relies on us to be trained, flexible, and readily available. In 2016 alone, we covered 55,000 shifts. UC has proposed to eliminate all rights for per diem nurses, not having the right for union representation or any other contractual right in a hospital setting puts both staff and patients at risk. As nurses, we need to be able to advocate for our patients free of fear of intimidation and harassment. We need to feel supported and valued. Who would you rather have taking care of your child or mother? A nurse who feels encouraged and appreciated by their employer, or one who's being made feel like a second-class citizen? We ask that you withdraw the per diem takeaways as well as 60 other takeaways that affect our quality of life and ability to care for our patients. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Serena Escobar. I'm a registered nurse at UC Davis. I've been a nurse for 4 years. I recently became involved in CNA due to the fact that my unit and the nurses were not receiving adequate breaks and meals. As we know, this job is incredibly difficult, both mentally and physically, and in order to be at our absolute best for our patients, we must be able to rest and rejuvenate. As I became more involved with the union, participating in leadership meetings and educating myself around the bargaining process, I learned that UC has proposed massive takeaways to the current pension structure. I also understand that UC Regents voted to approve this. As a younger nurse who plans on working with the UC system for the long term, this news was devastating and confusing to me. Why would UC want to put nurses and other workers' retirement security at risk? Why should we all not receive the same benefit and chance to look forward to retiring with dignity and security? I know many of my peers feel the same way. We came to UC in part because of the pension, knowing that this is a benefit of great value, even though some facilities in the area pay much more. Why would devalue us our work by reducing what employees put into the pension? This is short-sighted and wrong. We demand UC withdraw its proposal on the pension cuts. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Melody Hayworth. I'm a registered nurse at UCSF. I'd like to speak to the fact that UCSF on the Parnassus campus is not completely climate controlled. Our latest heat wave, we saw temperatures on the floor recorded to be 95 degrees. So I'm on a transplant unit, and we are an incredible team, and we work together, but this is embarrassing. We're the number one hospital in California. We're the number five in the country, and we cannot take care of our own patients. We cannot take care of our staff. 95 degrees on the floor is not a one-off. This happens every time the temperatures rise above 85 degrees in San Francisco. I trended it because I was curious to know how often that happens. And it's basically 56% of the year, it's over 85 degrees outside, which makes it intolerable inside. Please address this. We were told fiscal year 2019, but we were also told fiscal year 2017. Let's make this happen. You will all be patients. We will all be patients. We all have families.
I want to first thank CNA and NNU for being here. The students are paying attention. We want to know how we can help. Good morning, board. My name is Rigel Robinson. I have the privilege of serving the students of UC Berkeley as their external affairs vice president. I met many of you 3 years ago at this very same meeting at the November fall 2014 meeting where you all were prepared to vote for a dramatic tuition increase. I met many of you outside these doors in an active effort of trying to prevent you from getting into this building, which I wish I were here to apologize for, but frankly, it worked. We created a firestorm that ultimately resulted in negotiations between the governor and the UC that prevented that tuition increase from happening. Last year, we weren't so lucky, and this year, we hear that those conversations and those hikes will be back in January. The UC Student Association, the 242,000 students that it represents, have serious qualms about the high fee and high aid model that the UC has moved towards because we know that the increasingly high sticker price of a UC education keeps so many of our most qualified low-income students from applying to come to the UC in the first place. We need your help in making sure that not only you stand with us at the January meeting, but over the next weeks and months, you work with the governor's office to negotiate a budget that will buy out the impending tuition increase and make sure that it doesn't make it onto the agenda at the January meeting at all. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Sarah Abdeshayan. I'm the communications director for Student Regent Monhe, and I've been having a really difficult time explaining to the public what exactly this board does. There is a sort of mystique around the board, its actions, and its influence. And don't get me wrong, students really want to know what you're doing, but it is very difficult for students to learn more about the board when there is a lack of campus visits, a lack of information, and a lack of communication. This is why UCSA and Student Regent Monhe have collaborated to create the Regent Report Card in order to alleviate this mystery. It grades regents on two levels, accountability and voting record. There are multiple steps to getting a perfect grade, all of which are outlined in this flyer that we will distribute to you all soon. This is a very simple way to share what the board has done and to reflect upon what more the board can do to represent student needs. The Regent Report Card will be live on UCSA's website soon, and I'm sure that it will be helpful in upholding Regent accountability. Thank you.
Okay, next, I have about seven students from CalPERG, so what I'd like to ask you to do so we can hear from all issues is pick four of you, or I can set the timer for 4 minutes. So I'd appreciate it, however you want to do it. You want 1 minute each, four of you?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
go ahead. Just let us know who you are before you start. Yeah.
Good morning. My name is Maxwell Bassard, and I'm a sophomore at UC Berkeley and an intern with CalPERG. As you may know, CalPERG is a student-run nonprofit on the UC campuses and has been so since the 70s. We protect public interest and teach students how to run issue-based grassroots campaigns and be more civically engaged. CalPERG has worked on many issues, including clean energy, youth voter registration, and fighting food insecurity. This year, our focus is on pushing for more clean and renewable energy. At the last meeting, we heard about our university's progress towards carbon neutrality, and we'd like to thank the UC Regents for committing to carbon neutrality and for requesting more cap and trade funds for energy products that meet that commitment. But to really tackle climate change, we need to go further than carbon neutrality and towards 100% clean renewable energy. One way that we have done this is by building support for California Senate Bill 100 to move to clean energy. And we'd also like to see the UC Regents make more similar but more ambitious commitments for 100% renewable energy. And as institutional leaders in our community, we think that the UCs can do a great deal for the momentum of a clean energy future. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Elizabeth Nickerson. I'm a second year at UC Berkeley and an intern on the Hunger and Homelessness Campaign with CalPERC. We are working on some higher education affordability issues, and we're working to save the Pell Grant. Pell Grants are the foundation of our national investment in higher education and are essential for ensuring low-income students like myself have the opportunity to attend and complete college. I'd like to thank the UC system for increasing access to college by providing more Pell Grants than most other universities, including the Ivy Leagues. But Congress has proposed cutting the Pell Grant this year by billions. This cut would impact millions of students across the country. That's why we're working this year to call on our senators to stand up for Pell. We're also working to promote open education resources, basically free online textbooks, as well as to discourage the use of access codes. Access codes take course materials and put them behind a paywall. We believe students shouldn't have to pay to do their homework. And that's why I'm here today. We're looking to build support to stop the use of access codes and working with professors one-on-one to talk about alternative materials they can use in their classes. We would appreciate any support you could offer. Thank you.
Hi. So over 600 students have already volunteered in fall on our clean energy campaign at UC campuses. So far on this issue, CalPERC has generated 22,000 petitions from UC students in support and engaged 50 other student organizations on our campuses. We signed on 100 UC student government or group leaders in support of 100% clean energy. We also worked with the student governments at 7 UCs and the UC Student Association to pass student government resolutions in support of 100% clean energy. We've also been meeting with several decision makers on our campuses, like Wendell Braze, the Vice Chancellor of Sustainability at UC Irvine, Jordan Sager, the UCSB Campus Energy Manager, Chancellor Christ from UC Berkeley, and Chancellor Blumenthal from UCSC. This year, we plan to continue engaging students and faculty in holding educational events like a solar-powered concert to showcase the power of clean energy. Thank you for talking about this issue at your last meeting, and I hope you will continue to talk about how committing to 100% and making changes like switching campus natural gas plants to biofuel would help us hit our carbon neutrality goal. Thank you.
Hi. Thanks so much for talking about carbon neutrality and about ways that we can get more clean energy at our UCs. With CalPERC, we also want the entire state of California to commit to 100% clean energy, and we have a lot of support in the California State Legislature. So since the Public Engagement and Development Committee is meeting later today, I wanted to let you all know how students care so much about SB 100 and Kevin DeLeon's bill that he'll be pushing in January, and ask for your support as well. Just in the past few months, we've brought 35 students to lobby on SB 100 in Sacramento. We've had 3 press conferences in Riverside, Irvine, Walnut Creek, as a part of a coalition effort to do 11 press conferences across the state. We signed on over 100 student leaders from the UCs to be 100 student leaders in support of 100% clean energy in California. And I hope that you'll join us in getting the whole state to go 100% renewable energy, too. Thank you.
Thank you. So next, we have 17 members of AFSCME signed up to speak, but they've agreed to pool their time to 3 speakers. So we'll hear from Scott Wengel, Randy Johnson, and Catherine Leiberger, and they'll each have 2.5 minutes.
Good morning, Regents. Good morning, coworkers. And good morning, family. Everyone in here, it just occurred to me while I was sitting down over there that we really are all family. We all have the same goal here. We all want UC to do well. We want to be rewarded for it. But everyone in this room is part of the same team. My name is Scott Wingle. I worked as a contracted employee of ABM for nearly 3 years at UCLA. I worked every weekend, almost every holiday. I was a very good worker. I showed up all the time. I enjoyed my job. But we were let go. 85 of us were let go, and they brought in about 35 or 40. The rest of us were just cast aside. Cost-cutting. We were told it was going to be for students. Okay, well, I'd like to have my job instead of a student, but that's a little admirable. So that's what we were told, that they would be hiring, bringing in students. And then we found out it wasn't just students. They were bringing out people. They were hiring people from other garages. Okay, so it's a little different now. But now they're also going to be hiring people not even affiliated with the hospital or with parking at all. They were bringing in people with no managerial experience, people with no parking experience. And then you realize it was just a cost-cutting measure, and we really didn't feel like family anymore. We were pretty much pushed out. Currently, I don't have a job. I don't know what I'm going to do in a few months. I enjoyed my old job. I'd like to have my old job back. Really would ask everyone to bring back all the valet workers. These are people with families. 90% of them are immigrants. A lot of them don't speak English that well. They're very good at their job. This is something with the right wages you could support your family on. And I would really just like to plead again. We want our jobs back, all of us, all of the former valet employees. We'd like to be part of the UCLA family again. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Randy Johnson. I'm just recently retired from UCSF Medical Center. I was an MRI technologist there. And I'm here to talk about retiree health. You know, most countries, they really take care of their seniors. And this country, we seem to just throw them aside. And I urge you to stop the Trump-like cuts to the retiree health. In 2013, we voted as a union, as a people, to let you cut the retiree health, and now you're doing it again. And, you know, this is backbreaking work for us. It's for most of our people work very physical jobs. These nurses work very physical jobs. We move heavy patients. We have to move heavy equipment. The people who do the housekeeping and stuff, they're constantly scrubbing floors and doing stuff, and our bodies break down. We don't sit behind a desk. We don't push a pencil. We don't sit there with a little computer. We work hard. And it's just hard to work to age 65. I depend on retiree health. I got to retire at age 60 because I worked at UC. I guarantee you I could have made more money at other hospitals. I not that I feel like I was completely underpaid, but also the people who are at the bottom, the people who really, really have worked hard, they can't take this hike. For them, it'll be the difference for these people who retire as housekeeper and food service workers and hospital assistants. For them, it'll be the difference between paying their electric bill or paying their health care. And I think that it's time that UC stop just going after the pension and stop going after the retirees because they have money problems. Maybe you might want to look someplace else. Maybe it's time to quit giving all the executives these huge bonuses. Maybe it's time, you know, if UC's having money problems, then you need to look at the top because they're doing something wrong. Maybe there's too much at the top. I can tell you, in my own department, we have two managers going to every meeting. The supervisor is not necessarily on the floor supervising. They're going to meeting with the manager. There's just too much management at the top, and it's time for UC to maybe get a group together to look at how much management you have and cut back on your management. It's time to support your workers. It's time to become a public university again. It's time to support your students. It's time to listen. It's time to listen to you. We make these big, beautiful buildings.
Time, please.
These big, beautiful buildings you build. I have to tell you, that's not what makes the university. I'm going to sit down, but I just want to say one more thing. This is one person who supports the women that came up here and talked about the sexual harassment and the sexual misconduct. Thank you.
Regents, we have a problem on our hands. I'm Catherine Leibarger, and since I've been president of AFSCME 3299, we've seen tuition hikes, bloated bureaucracy, oversized executive pay, untimely raises for chancellors, and much, much more. And today we're hearing about painful benefit cuts for retirees and the abuse of contract workers. Regents, there's a pattern here, and it's troubling. What's taking place is a consistent failure to rein in the abuses of UC's top ranks. And it's happening at the expense of UC's most vulnerable, the students and their workers. And for what? So you can provide million-dollar payouts to disgraced ex-chancellors. So you can accumulate more $175 million slush funds. Or is it so you can blow hundreds of millions of dollars more on payroll systems that shortchange workers or on PR campaigns that promote a minimum wage that you don't even bother to enforce? University of California has gotten away from its core mission. We need to stop the wasteful spending, as my colleague just said, and get back to building pathways to the middle class, because there are too many of us at UC that have to worry about housing, hunger, and health care. This isn't Trump University. This is the University of California, and this is unacceptable. If we fail to act, we'll only succeed in transforming the nation's leading public institution into a national monument to income inequality. It's time to change things.
Seven. Thank you. So there's seven more individuals who signed up, and I'm not sure what your topic is. I'll call on all of them, but if you all have the same topic, maybe you could pick five of you. Dana Alpert, Nina Junjunwala, Kaya Portlow, Ada Tanyima, Uthira Bengray, Matthew Lewis, and Quentin Skillett.
Hello and good morning. My name is Dana Alpert and I am a junior at UC Berkeley here on behalf of the Associated Students of the University of California, UC Berkeley's student government that represents over 35,000 students. Anxiety and depression are extremely prevalent among young adults, especially college students. A 2016 UCSA survey measured mental health care accessibility, diversity of providers, and outreach to students on all nine campuses. The average grade was a C. As a resident assistant in the UC Berkeley dorms, I have consoled many of my residents who have experienced great anguish upon finding out that they could not receive services or even be seen by mental health care providers for at least 3 weeks during the middle of a stressful semester. I implore you all, as legislators of the UC system, to visit our campuses, understand the struggles, and allocate more funds toward accessibility and outreach services related to mental health. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Nina Junjunwala, and I'm an Associated Student of the University of California Senator. I am here today with Fossil Free California to challenge you all to think critically about your investments in the fossil fuel industry. Last spring, I was excited to learn that the Investments Committee made the bold move to divest $1.5 million from the Dakota Access Pipeline. However, that excitement didn't last long, as I learned that was only a small divestment from an estimated portfolio of $3 billion. We are here today to make a push for the remaining holdings of the securities of oil and gas drilling and refining firms to be divested. It is great that Regent Sherman claimed in the Office of the Chief Investment of the Region's annual report that these firms only represent 3% of the UC's total equity holdings and that he acknowledged the need to position your portfolio to transition to low carbon energy. However, I believe we can do more than low carbon energy. We can invest in 100% renewable energy and commit our campuses to only use renewable energy. It is imperative that we divest now.
Here are only a few of the reasons why. The recent California
time
fires affected both schools at UC Berkeley and Irvine. UC Merced and UCLA are located in the fifth and fourth most polluted cities.
I'm going to start the time for the next person.
This is the last point.
Okay.
And lastly, rising sea levels will directly impact the city of San Francisco, home to the very campus we are today. It's imperative that we divest now, but it's affecting us now.
Climate change is the greatest threat that this university works to understand and fight. Wildfires raged across the state this fire season, highly exacerbated by a changing climate. It wasn't long ago that Berkeley students were wearing masks around our school because of the severity of the smoke that was billowing from the tragedy unfolding in Santa Rosa. As students, we are experiencing climate change and are taught about how it will affect people across the globe in our classes, and yet we still see the university financially backing fossil fuel companies by remaining invested in them. As hard as the university is working towards being carbon neutral by 2025, we cannot truly be carbon neutral with holdings in fossil fuel companies. One is incompatible with the other. I'd like to suggest that divesting from fossil fuels would be financially wise and would not simply a morally imperative. Investing in renewable energy is to invest in a rapidly growing and thriving industry. The expansion of the solar industry can only be described as prolific. Solar jobs are growing 17 times faster than the U.S. economy. In 2016, the cost of a photovoltaic system fell by around 20%.
Time.
Meanwhile, after the 2015 oil pipeline spill near our Santa Barbara campus, Venoco, a smaller fossil fuel company, declared bankruptcy and is still currently unable to find a buyer for their leases on oil platforms in the Santa Barbara Channel, meaning the platforms will be decommissioned. As the fossil fuel industry fades, our endowment will depreciate until we divest. There is a clear and driving imperative to completely rid our university of these toxic investments. One, of course, is political and moral. The other is common sense financial policy. Why would we risk keeping our money in a volatile, doomed industry? We must pull our money out before we lose it. It was mentioned that combined we are the sixth largest endowment in the nation. It's now more important than ever to use that influence to address climate change as a systemic issue. Thank you.
Hi, good morning. My name is Quentin Silkett. I'm here today on behalf of Unite Here Local 11, the Hospitality and Restaurant Workers Union. I would like to extend my support to the UC Berkeley students here and also to the nurses here. My mom is also a registered nurse, which you guys say, you know, brings home to me. So I want to talk to you about the UC system, the UC's use of PricewaterhouseCoopers as your auditor. It's especially jarring that the UC's work with PwC, given that in 2013, the UC's management search for a new committee auditor reported that working with PwC would cost an extra $6.6 million over a five-year contract than working with a competitor. I would like to raise some additional concerns about your region's continuing use contracting of PricewaterhouseCoopers and ask you all to consider another firm at the end of your contract with them next year. In 2015, New York State regulators found that PwC helped its client, a Japanese bank, downplay concerns about the bank's transactions with individuals and companies that are subject to U.S. sanctions in Iran, Sudan, and Myanmar. According to the settlement agreement with the New York Department of Financial Services, PwC's work as a consultant for the bank in this matter did not demonstrate the necessary objectivity, integrity, and autonomy that is now required of consultants performing regulatory compliance work
for service
supervised by the department. We're asking that is this a company that is not good enough for New York State regulators, good enough for the UC system in 2018?
Thank you. You can leave your statement with us if you'd like.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so I believe all groups were represented well, and I've called on all individuals, so if there's anyone I missed, if not, that concludes public comment.
All right, thank you very much. I want to say that for all the regions, the Secretary's office takes notes on all the comments that are made, then covers them with me when necessary and with others for follow-up. With respect to the comments on that related to the health system, I know that Vice Chair of the Health Committee Sherman is here, Vice Chair of the Governance Compensation Committee, They'll be taking a look at those issues that were raised. I do want to, General Counsel Charlie Robinson, I think we need to make sure that's posted very clearly on the website what the region's policy is that was adopted with respect to allegations of regental misconduct. What our limitations are with respect to that, as you all know, we're appointed by the governor for terms we have no ability to remove ourselves, but we do have other authority under that policy. I want to make sure that people in the audience and people who take a look at that website can see it and understand the policy and how we try to carry that out. Let me say we have a lot of items on the agendas for the committees today, with Academic Senate and Finance meeting in the afternoon, audit meeting in the morning. What else is in the meeting in the morning? Public engagement. Public engagement. We're going to take a look at UCSF's funding program for UCSF, and there are a lot of important issues. I'm not going to go into it. You've seen the materials in the agenda. I do want to note that, like many of you, I've been visiting the campuses and talking with others, and just comment. I had a wonderful visit at Santa Cruz, and with banana slugs of all kinds, Senate and so forth. And we got to meet with the Sentinel paper there, the Chancellor and I, and the Foundation and alumni group. So it was really terrific. I want to thank Senate President or Head Shane White for the invitation to visit with the Academic Senate. That was a terrific set of discussions. I appreciate it very much. Also, the Student Association. I was able to visit with the Student Association in October, and I know that Regent Perez met with the Student Association in the next month, and Regent Anguiano is meeting in December, and I will be looking for the rest of you to be engaged as well, not only with the associations, Regent Mahe, but also with the campuses. I think it's very important that we do that. I think that student report card is not a bad idea. Every organization, every group always looks at it from their point of view, and we need to be aware of their point of view. It may not cover the entire picture of our responsibilities, but it's an important point of view we need to hear. I do want to draw attention to one item tomorrow on our agenda. And that is the PPIC report on the status of higher education in California. And it may get lost in the middle of other things that are be taking place tomorrow, but it's, from my point of view, it's a renewed sense on our part to take a look at some of the long-term issues that we face as a university and as a state. And those revolve around the cost of education. Those revolve around whose responsibility. The PPIC has said we're going to be a million degrees short in 2030, and we need to ask the question, what does that mean? Who's responsibility for what? And what is our responsibility to review our own curriculum through our Academic Senate to see if we're meeting the skills needs of today's students? There are a lot of issues involved in that, and I think it's going to continue on Thursdays in the future, whether it's in the academic or Senate Academic Committee on Wednesdays, but we're going to take on these issues as a board. The longer-term kinds of questions that we face, as they point out, there's no coordinating body for higher education in the state. It hasn't been for quite a few years. We need to take a lead with our comrades in Cal State, community colleges, private universities, and the other post-secondary institutions that provide skills, and define what those skills are, what our job is, and how we could possibly meet that need with the budgetary restraints that have been coming down over the recent years. So I just want to draw attention to that because it's so important as a beginning. And I know that I'd be maybe missed to not mention we have a special meeting following that, the end of our open session meeting of the Board of Regents on tomorrow. So with that, I'll turn to President Napolitano.
Point of parliamentary inquiry?
Oh, yeah.
I've asked this question before, got an answer, and am not sure that that the answer actually worked for me. Two-part question. One, how does a regent request an item be placed on the agenda for the full board? And second, given the policy that we adopted in the last year, what is the process? And I'll ask if it's appropriate for the general counsel to walk us through this. What is the process by which regents would review suggestions of regential misconduct? I know you said we're going to post it, but I think it's helpful when we're all in the room to get that answer so that we're all working in real time from the same set of information.
Okay, on the Charlie, I'll turn to you to answer both those questions. I'll tell you from my point of view, just personally, that you talk to me about an item you want to put on the agenda, I'll talk to the committee chair and try to get it on. But Charlie?
So with respect to your first question, any regent can make a request for an item to be placed on the agenda. The request goes to the chair of the board or the chair of the relevant committee, and that chair then has some discretion in terms of when the item would be scheduled. The item has to be scheduled in a way that the members' concern can be meaningfully heard. So,
and if a member were to find that they were not satisfied with the timing, is there an appeal process, a process where there is a debate or discussion about whether or not to agendize?
It's not specified in the governing documents, so I think typically when issues like that arise, they go to a governance committee, for example, but it's not specified in the bylaws. And then with respect to your second question, policy 1112 provides a process for review of allegations of misconduct by regents. It's essentially a two-step process that starts with a preliminary investigation and then potentially a formal investigation afterwards. The preliminary investigation is conducted by my office. There's some determination whether or not conclusions can be reached with reasonable investigative techniques available to the office. There is also a three-person regents committee that works with the general counsel with respect to any findings in the preliminary or the subsequent formal investigation.
So I think that just to complete that, the general counsel makes a recommendation based on an initial review of the cost involved in resolving an allegation and also takes into consideration whether there are other processes going on. So, for instance, a lawsuit on allegations usually will get in the way of a determination by this board of going through the whole process of doing the same thing that the lawsuit would do.
That's
part of your recommendation to the three-person committee, which consists, as I recall, of the chair, the vice chair, and is it the chair of the audit?
Governance. And help me on that one. I think it may be the chair of governance.
I think it's the chair of governance.
Yeah.
Is it the case that one could be initiated and the complete board wouldn't be fully aware of a process that's begun but is not yet gotten to a certain stage?
I don't know that there is a specific provision for a report out to the full board,
right,
but I think
that's my question.
Practice.
Is it possible that there would be an investigation going on that the full board would not be aware of because of where it is at that where it is in that initial review?
Frankly, I'd have to look at the policy to answer that question specifically. It's 1112, and I can.
Regent Perez, I think the answer is yes.
Right.
And I think what it means is that if we haven't and if we missed communicating with the board with respect to the process that we went through, you and I and Regent Reese, I believe, then at that point, if it hasn't been communicated, we need to communicate to the rest of the board, and we'll do that.
There are stages of an investigation in which nobody would be read in because, for example, in stage one, right, the Office of General Counsel would be solely aware of the under... Right, so that's a distinction that I think is important to note.
Not entirely, because the Office of General Counsel would be required to make the allegation known to the three-person committee. So there's always a group of regents who are aware of what's going on with an allegation of misconduct.
Right, but the full board wouldn't know at that stage.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And at the right point,
then the full board needs to know what the three committee members, where it is in the process. Thanks. I think that's helpful. It doesn't resolve the issue for the moment, but it's helpful for everybody to understand what our authority is and isn't. I still would like it published, make sure it's on our website so people can see.
So I just looked at it this morning. It is on the website.
All right. Good. I draw people's attention to that then. Now, thank you for those comments, Regent Perez, and clarifying that, and thank all of you who are visiting with the campuses and taking your time. Sometimes people don't even know that you're on the campus, so it's important to let as many people know, including the student, the newspaper, which can publicize the fact that you've been there, So let me now call on the president for her remarks. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Chair Kiefer, and she's not here, but I'd like to recognize Monica Lozano for her remarkable service as regent and as previous chair of the board. I look forward to seeing her tomorrow at the regents' meeting. Like others, I deeply appreciate all that Monica has done as a regent, especially her efforts to expand opportunity for Californians who aspire to a UC education and to uphold the university's values. And as we approach the 150th anniversary year of the University of California, I think it is worthwhile to revisit the foundational values that have made the UC the best public research university system in the world, and to reflect on the university's mission of teaching, research, and public service. What makes UC the best is the combination of access and excellence. These are values that have characterized the university in various ways since the founding of Berkeley in 1868. Even during the earliest days of California's first public university, providing educational opportunity to all young Californians was a top priority. So it's application month at the University of California, a natural time for us to focus on access. High school seniors and community college students began submitting their applications on November the 1st, and the deadline is November 30th, with one important exception. The process was disrupted for some applicants this fall by the wildfires that scorched large stretches of California, killed or injured scores of people, and left many without homes. The University of California is committed to supporting applicants affected by the fires, so we've extended the application deadline to December the 15th for those affected who may need additional time to complete their applications. Meanwhile, we're reaching out to students and families across the state to make sure they know we want every qualified Californian to apply for admission to UC and that they understand how to apply for financial aid. Just 2 weeks ago, Regent Lozano and I participated in an awards lunch celebrating parental engagement with educational institutions. At that lunch, I was able to share the stories of first-generation UC students and encouraged everyone to apply for financial aid as their children apply for admission. And I invited them to advocate with us for the state resources needed to support continued enrollment growth and the needs of students, and for other collective actions to help shape federal and state policies that advance the university's missions. And we heard a comment in public comment about advocacy on the tax legislation currently pending in the House of Representatives, and I want you to know that we are all over that, particularly as it affects our graduate students. I specifically encouraged those at the luncheon to join the UC community in advocating for federal legislation to protect our DACA students as we pursue legal remedies to the rescission of the DACA program. In addition to the lawsuit filed by the University of California in federal court, UC joined other plaintiffs earlier this month in asking a federal judge to keep the program operating while the legal motions proceed. Last week, UC Riverside Chancellor Kim Wilcox and I traveled to Moreno Valley, where we visited Valley View High School and Moreno Valley Community College, just east of Riverside. During an Achieve UC rally at Valley View High, we spoke with hundreds of juniors and seniors about the value of a UC education. The seniors in the group later received guidance on completing their admission statement and applications, and the juniors were coached on selecting high school courses that will make them competitive applicants next year. Later that day at Moreno Valley Community College, we visited with participants in UMOJA, an African-American Student Success Program. At this meeting, Southern California students learned about financial aid and UC's transfer pathways designed to streamline the process of transferring from community college to UC campuses. And Chancellor Wilcox and I had the opportunity to hear directly from students about their interests and concerns. As part of the larger UC Achieve outreach, our chancellors and senior staff are meeting with high school seniors and students and community colleges across the state this fall, including Cabrillo College near Santa Cruz, where Chancellor Blumenthal and I will meet with students next week. Our message is straightforward. If you work hard and meet admission requirements, there's a place for you at UC. And for most, there's also financial aid that makes a UC education financially attainable. Now, all of us are well aware of the university's excellence in research. The national laboratories affiliated with UC all have played a central role in achieving and maintaining this excellence for decades. At this meeting, the Regents will be asked to authorize me to advance the university's bid for the management and operating contract for Los Alamos National Laboratory. The University of California's commitment to the lab goes back 74 years, and I hope our association with Los Alamos will continue for many more years ahead. Likewise, the University of California has held the Berkeley Lab management and operating contract since the early 1940s. The Regents will be asked to authorize me to sign and execute a modified contract for the Berkeley Lab negotiated by UC and the Department of Energy. The modification reduces UC's overall risk exposure, provides greater autonomy for day-to-day operations, and improves performance accountability. And across the UC system, on our campuses, at our medical centers, and through our affiliated national laboratories and agriculture and natural resource operations, the University of California strives to serve the public good. Now, as a public service, the University of California is stepping up to help address issues and questions related to the First Amendment and civic engagement in our nation. As the birthplace of the free speech movement, UC is uniquely suited to lead a concerted exploration of the state of free speech on our nation's college campuses, students' relationships with the First Amendment, and what tomorrow holds for engaging people in the American democracy. So that's why we recently launched the National Center for Free Speech and Civic Engagement at UCDC, the university's location in Washington. A key component of the center will be a fellowship program that will draw from leading public policy thinkers, legal scholars, social scientists, journalists, and others of different backgrounds, experiences, and views. The application process opened last week, and the advisory board will choose the first group of fellows. I'm deeply grateful to UC Irvine Chancellor Howard Gilman and Berkeley Law Dean Erwin Chemerinsky for co-chairing the center's advisory board. As many of you know, they are the co-authors of the recently published book, Free Speech on Campus. This is a significant and exciting undertaking with many dimensions. Tackling these complex issues won't be easy, but it will be well worth the effort. Our campuses and our country need and deserve this. And then finally, some bittersweet news. After nearly a decade of service to the University of California Office of the President, Sandra Kim, our Associate Vice President of Finance, will leave UC next month to pursue other professional opportunities. Sandra has been a remarkable employee whose work has translated into hundreds of millions of dollars in savings and new revenue for the university. Among her many accomplishments, Sandra led the Student Housing Initiative, which is slated to add 14,000 new beds for students on our campuses by 2021, and worked with the Merced campus to create an effective financing approach for Merced 2020, the $1.3 billion effort to double the size of that campus. Thanks to Sandra's work, the university also maintained its AA ratings with credit rating agencies during a very challenging economic period. I know you will all join me in thanking Sandra for her dedicated service to the University of California and wish her the very best of luck in her future endeavors. Chair Kiefer, that concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Madam President. Let me now. With the meeting, I want to call on Faculty Representative White to present his remarks.
Thank you, Chair Kiefer. The University of California is a research university, a public research university, and one of the very finest. But what is a research university, and what does this mean for our undergraduate students? A research university encompasses the unity of teaching and research and the unending nature of academic inquiry through academic freedom. First, the professor and student are not just to teach and to be taught, but together for the common pursuit of knowledge. Students do not simply master a craft. Students learn to think, to create, to generate new knowledge, to develop the tools that will let them adapt, contribute, and flourish as technologies and societal needs change multiple times over a single career. What is learned today will likely be outdated in just a few years' time in the currency of the knowledge-based economy. Vocational training is not enough for the research university. We teach students how to teach themselves so they may create and innovate throughout their careers, have a broader range of career choices, as well as deeper civic and public engagement. Tools for lifelong learning and a deeper understanding of the world will result in more productive participation and in greater happiness. Second, the nature of scholarship, the arena for the pursuit of knowledge, is unending and inexhaustible, from abstract art to Zymergy, and other disciplines that are still emerging or not even yet conceived. Every discipline confronts and challenges the world's problems. The humanities and social sciences contribute deeply to their dedicated scholars and broadly to all, including the entrepreneur and the basic scientist. Clark Kerr coined the term multiversity, seeing the university as a complex plurality of various, often competing communities engaged in a myriad of activities with a range of extra-university interests and impacts, much more than John Henry Newman's concept of a dedicated community of scholars pursuing knowledge for its own sake. We are no ivory tower. Third, academic freedom, freedom from external or internal constraint of scholarship is paramount. Von Humboldt, the German father of the idea of the modern research university, explained 200 years ago, the state must understand intellectual work will go on infinitively better without it. Such ideas define the foundation of a complex relationship. Only the state can guarantee autonomy. In return, the university must be of use to the state and to the broader public, but not always immediately so. Clark Kerr expressed this foundational underpinning. The two greatest gifts to the University of California have been the institutional autonomy given to its Board of Regents in the Constitution of 1878 and the unprecedented grant of authority the Board assigned to the Senate, Academic Senate, in 1920. These two gifts constitute the institutional foundation for growth and distinction of the University of California. These gifts have allowed the university to take a long-term, steady view and craft carefully deliberated responses to challenges that are fundamental to the enterprise of teaching, research, and public service, and the university's overall role in society, and to become the world's preeminent public research university. In this highly politicized time, a narrow understanding of the university's role is a particularly dangerous threat. In the research university, students are surrounded by world-class authorities, not simply those who absorb, transmit, and disseminate knowledge, but those who create the state of the art and the foundations of discovery. Students learn to confront new knowledge that may conflict with their prior beliefs. In the classroom, students are challenged. Outside the classroom, students challenge themselves, take initiative through participation in the broader city of intellect to adapt and work and live together across all divisions. This is much more than the sum of Newman's traditional English college residential experience and von Humboldt's concept of combining research and study. So, the undergraduate student in a public research university is not a widget on a production line in one of nine cookie-cutter factories, but an individual and unique participant in discovery on a singular campus. Whether a student of the arts or a STEM major, whether or not she participates in active research, she is part of an ecosystem that discovers and advances knowledge. She, yes, the majority of our undergraduates have long been she's, not he's, is surrounded by professors, lecturers, postdocs, graduate students, and undergraduate peers, a part of a complex ecosystem. This ecosystem is not top-down nor bottom-up, but an interwoven community of authentic individuals together involved in individual original creation. Our young applicants understand the distinction between the University of California and the other segments of our state's higher educational system. They have made the choice that best suits them. Our students are prepared to make the additional, personal, and financial commitment to attend one of our nine undergraduate campuses. They come to us rather than our private peers because they understand and value how our wider public engagement and how our service mission is a key part of the reason for our being an engine of discovery and advancement. They come to us because we are not walled off from society or separate from the people. They come to us because they know what the public research university means to the process of their education. The critical thinking skills, the learning to invent and discover, to their careers, to their interactions with the wide world, and to their lifelong personal happiness. Our low-income students succeed in the California workforce, earning more on average within 5 years than their parents' combined incomes. Alumni who are Pell Grant recipients are concentrated in public service, healthcare, and education across the state. By all measures, the University of California is not only the greatest engine of social mobility in our state, but in the nation. We don't need the rankings or the statistics to know this. Our 200,000 plus undergraduates tell us so and make it so. In the last 20 years, in keeping with our obligation under the master plan, our enrollment has doubled, a remarkable achievement, but our applicant pool has tripled. Thus, the university has become more selective. A growing proportion of young Californians want to attend the university. Our young have voted with their feet, or at least with their applications. The value of a UC public research education has steadily risen. Even as the university has become more selective through applicant pressure, it has better served the people of California. Over the past 20 years, our enrollment of first-generation students has more than doubled, and our enrollment of underrepresented minority students has more than tripled. The people's appreciation of education at the state's public research university has steadily risen. Our applicant pool has enlarged dramatically. The faculty of this great research university can do and will do what the state and the board want. But let us do it the right way. Well-intended but ill-founded edicts, such as applying a 2-to-1 ratio of freshmen to transfer students, not just system-wide, as it was, but at each of our undergraduate campuses, or by mandating unequal campus caps on non-resident enrollment, hurt our least resourced campuses and their students, the most diverse in the system. Likewise, mandates to enlarge enrollment without adequate funding are not just misplaced, but destructive. Funding is needed for infrastructure, not only for the marginal cost of additional enrollment. there is more to be done. And the University of California cannot do it alone. A trusting partnership with the state is needed. Enrollment must be funded as infrastructure. Our most diverse classes ever must not be shortchanged or denied the quality of education that their predecessors received. All the rust and corrosion that I described in September, poor student-to-faculty ratios, large class sizes, denigrate their potential. Californian high school students' graduation rates continue to rise, but huge discrepancies between wealthy and low-income communities remain. Likewise, transfer rates from the community college system to both CSU and UC vary by region. All segments, all stakeholders, must work together to address inequalities. Bob Clark, author of The Higher Education System, recognized that it does not make much sense to evaluate business firms according to how much they act like universities, nor does it make much sense to do the reverse. Instead, the discovery-centered nature of our task is fostered in diversity of outlook, the autonomy of persons, groups, and endemic uncertainty and ambiguity. We don't make widgets. And while we do regularly invent new technologies, cancer medicines, vaccines, tastier fruit, we are so much more than that. The faculty hear you, the state, and the board. Please listen carefully to us. Let the university better understand the state, and let the state better understand the university. Together we go. Chair Kiefer, thank you. That concludes my remarks.
All right, thank you. And now I call on the President to present a report on honors and achievements.
Thank you, Chair Kiefer. For the first time last month, the U.S. Department of Education released data on outcomes for Pell Grant recipients. The data show that UC is a leader in enrollment and graduation of low-income students. 42% of all UC students in the cohort studied were Pell Grant recipients, compared to 22% at other public institution members of the AAU. And 81% of these UC students graduated within 6 years, and we're working to increase that number. No CSU or AAU school had both a higher percentage of Pell enrollees and a higher Pell Grant graduation rate than any UC campus. Each year, the MacArthur Fellowships, also known as the Genius Awards, are given to individuals who have demonstrated creativity, originality, and promise for future advances. This year, 5 of the MacArthur Award winners have ties to the University of California. They include Stefan Savage, a renowned cybersecurity expert and professor of computer science at UC San Diego. UC faculty members also made an impressive showing in a prestigious award for early career scholars announced last month. Nearly one quarter of the 2017 Packard Fellowships in Science and Engineering went to UC faculty, with recipients at Berkeley, UCLA, and Santa Cruz. At UC Santa Barbara, engineering professor and Nobel laureate Shuji Nakamura has been awarded the 2017 Mountbatten Medal for the Institution of Engineering and Technology. The award recognizes Professor Nakamura's pioneering development of blue LEDs as high-efficiency, low-power light sources. We're also proud of the university's connection to Barry Barish, a UC Berkeley graduate and one of the winners of the 2017 Nobel Prize in Physics. He was honored for his work on the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, also known as LIGO, which in 2015 made the first direct observation of gravitational waves. Innovation, invention, and creative thinking continue to thrive on UC campuses. 2 recent Berkeley grads and a medical student at UCSF have won Fast Company's 2017 Innovation by Design Award for a low-cost medical device that diagnoses pneumonia. And last month, the University of California was one of 8 recipients nationwide of the EPA's Excellence in Green Power Award, which recognizes UC's commitment to green energy. In recognizing UC's efforts, the EPA noted that UC purchases more than 128 million kilowatt hours of green power annually, supplying about 11% of its total electricity, or enough energy to power 10,000 average American homes each year. And University of California campuses continue to be named among the highest quality institutions of higher education in the world. UC News and World Report has published its 2018 Best Global Universities rankings. On this comprehensive list of 1,250 public and private universities in 74 countries, UC Berkeley is ranked number 4 in the world. In all 4 UC campuses rank in the top 25, and all 10 campuses are recognized on the list. Also last month, Walter Monk, Professor Emeritus at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego, celebrated his 100th birthday. Known as the Einstein of the oceans, Dr. Monk and his scientific achievements have helped build the foundation of excellence that the University of California is known for today. And finally, I want to recognize the many members of the UC family who have shown remarkable compassion and selflessness as they work to help those affected by recent natural disasters, including the devastating Northern California wildfires, Hurricane Harvey in Texas, and Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, among others. These efforts included UCLA volunteers who built digital maps to help aid workers in Puerto Rico, Berkeley student, staff, and alumni who rolled up their sleeves and helped out at evacuation centers for Sonoma County residents, and UC Davis student and faculty veterinarians who provided care and performed search and rescue missions for animals injured in the California wildfires. In times of crisis, UC campus communities come together determined to use their skills and ability to help those in need. It's a public service instinct that has defined the character of the University of California since its inception, and we continue to pursue that mission today. Chair Kiefer, that concludes my remarks.
All right. Thank you, Madam President. We're going to now break into our committee meetings, two different floors. Just to clarify, the Compliance and Audit Committee will be meeting in this room, Robertson Auditorium, and the Public Engagement and Development Committee will meet downstairs in the room downstairs. Governance and Compensation will meet downstairs following the end of the other, when they get out of the other meetings. When the morning meetings adjourn, lunch will be available upstairs. Is that over here in Coblenz? Yeah. And also in the room next to this one in the Fisher Banquet Room, it says, please be prepared to begin the afternoon committee meetings at 1 p.m. Now, as a matter of our normal course, ask the secretary to read the announcement concerning any closed session meetings that occur during the day.
The board and several of its committees will meet in closed session later today and tomorrow in the Compliance and Audit Committee to consider items C6 through C10X. In the Governance and Compensation Committee to consider items G4 and G5X. In the National Laboratory Subcommittee to consider item N1X. In the Finance and Capital Strategies Committee to consider items F1 and F2X. And also tomorrow morning as the full board to consider reports from those committee meetings that had closed sessions today. And also to consider special meeting item B2X. All is duly noticed. This announcement is made in compliance with pertinent open meeting laws.
All right, thank you. We're adjourned for the time to our committees.